Okay, I think we'll get started. We need to get started sort of quickly today because Doug has another engagement, but thank you for attending today. Any quick thoughts or comments about previous lectures, handout material or stuff? If you have any questions, you can certainly talk to me after class or send me an email. I'm here for you, so you can take advantage of me. Next Thursday, we have a tour of the VA spinal cord injury. And who's thinking about going to that next Thursday? Okay. Between after Doug talks, we're going to pass around a carpool sign-up sheet that will facilitate everybody getting there by cars.
When does it start?
I'm going to have to check with the Dr. Creasy to make sure we're in sync, but hopefully around the same time. And one thing I should ask students is, what time do you think you can get there? Can you get there at 4 o'clock, 4:15, 4:30? What would be a good starting time? Doesn't matter. Okay. We'll figure that out. Where'd he go? Oh, okay. Next Tuesday, Mike Norell is going to be speaking. You might remember him. He presented a few projects a couple weeks ago. And his background is he's been doing prosthetics and orthotics for over 30 years. He has three businesses in the Bay Area fitting prosthetics and orthotics. So he has a good perspective on that field. And one thing I should say is that in talking about the situation in Haiti, you know, with all the injuries and stuff, somebody mentioned that it's going to be a country of amputees. So things like prosthetics and orthotics are going to be pretty important. So that's next Tuesday. But today, our first speaker, first of two, is going to be Doug Schwant. And I've known Doug for over 30 years. He began his career in rehab engineering with a class at Stanford, ME210, which is now ME310. And he created a hand bike, which he'll talk about in his talk. And after he graduated, he continued to work on the hand bike, and then he got employed at the VA Rehab R&D Center where I was. So I'm taking advantage of our co-workership to have him speak today. And he worked on lots of different projects, which he'll talk about, including one with the finger spelling hand project that I mentioned in the first class. And he's doing consulting, and he's worked on just a variety of different things. So, the perspective that Doug brings to all this is that he has this background in mechanical engineering, design, fabrication, knows a lot about the process. So that's what he's going to be talking to us today about. So without further ado, I'll hand it over to Doug. I'll bring up the slides. Okay. Forward, and here's your laser.
Let's see, am I pointing at the wrong? There, helps to point out the right end there.
Okay, so let's see, what I like to talk about are the design process, because that's what I'm usually involved in, and things, you usually talk about the things you're most comfortable with, besides springboard diving, which is my other love. We'll talk about that next time. And I also, when I started in the rehab engineering field, I was started with a kind of a fun, exciting project, an arm-powered bicycle, a two-wheeler, which I'll get to. And so one of the things that I wanted to do is just touch on a few of the projects that I've had a chance to work on. And if those of you in the room, or I know some are already designing things, But I'd like it to be sort of an inspiration to you. Look for projects that are fun and exciting, and also they can be exciting not just because they get a lot of attention or they're a highly funded project, but they could be a very simple project, like a device for someone that's, like in Haiti, that'll have there'll be a lot of amputees and might need to work on new prosthetic limbs that are very inexpensive. So let's start with the design process. This is something that I touch on when I'm doing my work. If I get lost, like what am I supposed to be doing now? I want to make sure that I get to sort of follow this outline, and we'll just step through it. First, it's important, of course, to start with a need, and probably Dave and others in this room have had the experience of having a clever idea or a technology, some cute way to do something, then you go out and look for a need. And that's the way it's kind of fun for us to do, but usually the need is supposed to lead it. If you can make it work, if you have a clever idea, a mechanism or something, and you can find the need, go for it. So then another important early step is to see if what you're working on has already been done. And it happens quite a bit. And I've had students visit me when I used to work at the VA with Dave, visit me, and they'll come over to learn about the bikes they're doing some project here on campus, and they show up and I say, I've got these volumes of collected material from the Human Powered Speed Championships, and just collected from all over the place. You can't find anywhere else. And what shocked me was I get the response, I don't want to look at any of that. I don't want it to interfere with my creativity. And to me, that's what makes someone a tough, a better designer is look at all that and still come out with something that's going to be useful and maybe do something better, like with Molly and her wheelchair she was telling me about. Then the conceptual design is where you go to the whiteboard, you sketch on envelopes, you start working in SolidWorks. You have an idea, just start making it real with little foam core models, whatever you have handy, parts of other devices. Just start generating a number of possibly competing designs. From there, of course, you have to sort of pick one to work on. Can't usually take all of them along simultaneously.
Just like any other project, you have to get into the details. And usually at this point, getting into the details and trying to make something work.
Usually find that I've like gone down a blind alley or something's not quite working. And it's the most frustrating time for me, usually.
But looking back at a number of projects, it was also the most important time, because when you become the most frustrated, the most anxious, it's not going to work, I'm barked up the wrong tree. You get your ideas, you get your aha moments. And if you can press on through these times when you're not sure of how you're going to do something, that's when I find you get your best creativity. So anyway, you go through the process, you test it, make sure it works, document it, and of course you want to try to get the product out, and Dave will go through that in this course with you quite a bit. How do you get the products out? Right, Dave, you talk about tech transfer?
I have talked about it a little bit, but it's a quite difficult task to get things commercially viable.
It was a surprising long process at the VA where we used to work, and some products are out. The hand bikes sort of out, and there are a number of other products that are out there. The fingerspelling hand, not yet, but we tried. Any questions?
Okay, so I'll just touch
on a few of the projects. These are some of my favorite projects, mostly because of the people that I work with, and then also when you finish the device, it's sort of fun. I like something that you can end up playing with.
This is, as the title suggests, it's an arm-powered bicycle for people who are unable to use their legs for powering or to put their foot down when they come to a stop. So the side wheels are like, they're kind of like training wheels, except that they can be lifted up for balancing on two wheels, going around corners, and it can be fastened down for going in and out of elevators and up ramps. So we built a variety of these hand bikes, including one for a little girl in Oregon, and another one here for able body or for adults. This is just a quick shot of some of the history of the bikes. Peter Axelson, who's in, let's see if I can get this right here. You'll hear from Peter Axelson next month, I believe. And he's a great speaker. He's very inspirational. He came to our ME210 class, which is the equivalent of 310 now, and said, let's do a new type of cycle. If we can do a bike, that'd be great. If we can do a tricycle, just something that works better than what's on the market. So he was... He's the man behind the bike. He came and let's do something that'll improve the recreation of people in, without the use of their legs. So we built models, foam core models. And this is a bike that was cut up from other bikes in a junk pile. It was overnight, basically. My brother. I went up to Oregon and visited him, and he said, let's just cut up some bikes and make something to ride. So you can do quick prototypes that actually work. This is the end of our student project when I was a student here. We delivered a bike that was low enough to the ground that you could put your hands down when you came to a stop. If these side wheels didn't work that well, you could put your hands down. We raced it in the Human Powered Speed Championships up to 25 miles an hour. Had a project going up at University of British Columbia
because they were very interested in it.
The guy that's riding it here, Rick Hansen,
pushed his wheelchair around the world, basically. He was doing fundraising, and
he was part of the project. Let's see. We also have had a tandem bicycle called the Sunburst. It's arm and foot power in the front. The steering is here in the back. Our first tandem was sticking a bicycle on the back of a
hand bike.
And the fun thing about this version was that there was steering in the back and steering in the front.
So you might imagine it's like two people hanging onto the same steering wheel.
Yeah.
Side wheels. Yeah, there's a fold down kickstand on each side.
So when you come to a stop, you can level it out.
And the
what I like to
point out in this photo is that, or to ask, is
can you tell who's if someone has a disability in the picture besides me and my obvious mental disabilities? Can you tell? Yeah, well, it turns out
that Diana, who's on the
front, hadn't been on a bike in 12 years. She has muscular dystrophy.
No,
I'm sorry, multiple sclerosis is a difference, of course.
No, there's a big difference. And so she was using her hand, in this case even one hand, to help her legs through the weak part of the stroke.
And she was very delighted to be on the bike.
The picture was taken up in Ottawa when we brought it out at a conference.
Any other questions about the bikes?
Okay. So moving on to other projects. This was a
device that could be used in a sort of a disabling environment. If you're floating around in space, you don't have the benefit of gravity to react for your force
to react your strengthening forces against. So we worked on this device, developing a rope and pulley system that basically you harness one limb against the other. If you pull your if you pull your biceps with one arm, you're going to be using the biceps on the other to resist.
And Scott here is shown in the picture here. We were both on the Vomit Comet, NASA's Vomit Comet, testing it. The airplane that goes out over the Gulf and does the parabolas. He took it into space, which is why this picture's in here, and was able to do leg presses of 1,200 pounds of force while in space with a device that weighs 3 or 4 pounds, maybe 5 pounds. Jim Anderson is shown here. Jim is a very special colleague of Dave and mine. Worked with us at the VA, trained at NASA, but worked with us at the VA as our machinist. He machined the hardware for this, and it had to be flight hardware, flight tested. Even though he had trained at NASA, he had never had anything flown in space. So he put a lot of effort into making these foot plates and all of the attachments
perfectly and very smooth and
nice looking.
Any questions about this?
Okay, I'm just going to touch on these briefly. This is a project with my client in Chicago or near Chicago. We developed a robot that
assists physical therapy.
So
for me as a mechanical designer and like mechanisms, this was a fun project to work on.
There's all kinds of
mechanisms that allow the free movement of your hips while you walk.
And it's got a torso controller, which is hard to see here. There's, you can see it here.
Where it could actually, if you start to lean one way, it can give you a little boost, or it can give you a little push, too, so that to make you react properly to perturbations in your walking.
Step through this. This is a my most recent project with them. It's a DARPA,
Defense Department's research arm,
funded
project to come up with a
prosthetic arm.
And it's to sort of push the envelope in the technology. These are not cheap. They're very expensive still. There were 25, 30 engineers and programmers and people all over the world working on this device. Probably $100 million, I think. Not just for one arm, but the project's been going on for several years.
So I got to work on the fingertips, which are, they have little sensors in them.
And the idea here is that you could, if someone's lost their arm, amputated different positions, you would put this prosthetic arm on, and you could, it would connect to with EMGs or directly into the nerves somehow. And you could, for instance, close your eyes and move your finger along a surface. You could find the edge, and you could feel the texture. So you're moving it just by thinking, I'm going to move my hand and my fingers. And then the sensors in the fingertips are feeding back to the residual nerves from your amputated arm. You can feel. It makes little tapping motions on your skin above those nerves at the same frequency of the little vibrations that you're feeling. So you could close your eyes and essentially feel. Again, that's the
intent of this project.
Yes.
How
does
the battery operate? Like what's the
yeah, there's a battery that sits in the, I think it's in this area. I work mostly in the palm and the fingers, but there's batteries in here because it depends on, you could have a below the elbow amputee. Yes, Susan.
Just what I've read and heard, I mostly focused on my part of the design, but the article, the National
Geographic article that just came out this month, actually, or last month, talks about a woman who's been playing with these devices, and it takes weeks to begin to reprogram. They have to first
find all the nerve endings, and then they have to have her think of a task and see which nerves fire, I think, and then somehow put it all together. So it's a big, it's a long process. Yeah.
Okay.
And just the, as the other end, oh, yes. As I understand it, there's surface EMGs or implantable wires. They go with very, very thin wires down into the muscles. And there's a neurosurgeon at Rehab Institute of Chicago who figured out that he could take these residual nerves and transplant muscles, I think, from other places, or take the nerves and reroute them into the, I guess, the pectoral muscles. Those nerves, as they re-innervate, they start to grow out again. If they grow into a larger muscle, it amplifies the signal. So they were able to, get more out of the signal.
This article,
I didn't bring along the magazine, but this article shows a woman with an amputee. Above the elbow amputee, and it has all of these different locations where they poked into the muscles. Yes. Let's see. I've forgotten the exact way. It's on the order of a normal arm. Yeah, we were constantly making assessments of the weights of our design as we were going along, and then I was a subcontractor to another subcontractor to another, and way up the line they were gathering all this and making these up-to-date mass calculations. So it's supposed to be on the order of a female or male 50 percentile human arm with the strength of a human arm and many of the functions, but of course it doesn't have. As I understand it, there's 32 intrinsic muscles in the hand alone.
And this has like 10 or 12. These fingers that are shown here are. Oops, what did I do? Screw that.
So, sorry about that. Push the wrong button.
Yeah. It comes off at night.
Yeah, they would take it off at night. And I think eventually the cuff would go have the EMG electromyogram sensors built right into it, and it fits right over. No, I don't think so.
And
it doesn't get much it hasn't got much attention, but one of our colleagues, Maurice LeBlanc, has been working for several years on a. I don't know if he's coming in to talk this day, but if you get a chance to meet Maury and hear about his hand. He's working on a very inexpensive hand that's being made and shipped all over the world for landmine victims. This is basically to try to push the technology.
Okay. The last project. What we call the differential pressure
walking assist. Not very creative name, but it tells about how it works. If you put your lower body into a bag and you make a seal with a flap rubber seal you might find on a kayak and you pressurize it, it'll lift you just like a cork in a champagne bottle when it releases. It'll just lift you right up. It's the invention of Rob Whalen, who's another one of our colleagues over at NASA.
So if you've had a stroke or
you're suffering from Parkinson's, you might have had
surgeries, you have an injury, you can
get in this device, turn the pressure on, and start walking and running at whatever percent of your body weight. And if NASA's also very interested in
using
this concept of air pressure to either increase your body weight by drawing a vacuum on your lower body or a pressure on your upper body so that you could exercise in space.
And they're also interested in this
device because you can simulate what it would be like to walk on Mars or the lunar surface just by adjusting the pressure. Yes. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, this was at the VA, and now there's a product that Sean Whalen, who's the son of, I don't know if anybody knows Sean, he's Rob Whalen's son, and he finished his undergraduate mechanical engineering degree here, and he and his buddies just started making it as a product. I was in Chicago working on those other things, and I would be rollerblading along Lake Michigan and get a call from Sean, and he'd say, where do you get these bags made, and how do you do this? And so they've got a product that's selling all over the world for hospitals, for professional baseball teams, and the players get injured and they want to keep working out. Okay, yeah, I'm wrapping up. You can visit. They're right across the bay,
and you can check out these websites and
see how this stuff works. Any questions?
On the Jeep thing, where NASA's looking at the Jeep?
Yeah.
Pushing down?
Yeah.
How do you do that a little bit, just to make a little word or two about...
Oh, how it works?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I see. Okay. So, like the physics of it, that as I understand it, if you have a room pressure,
like in this case, if you have room pressure around your upper body, and you pump air
pressure into the bag
that's enclosing the treadmill and everything in there.
It's just a bag and treadmill. And you're sticking down in there. The higher pressure is acting orthogonally to every surface of your body. I mean, you've got the ambient pressure also acting against every surface of your body. And I think of it this way. If you put your arm out, there's like 1 square inch or 1 square millimeter of your arm will have a certain pressure and force on it, and the other side of your arm will too, and by the time you finish canceling that off all around your upper body, all you're looking at is the cross-sectional area of your waist, and the same thing about your lower body. So that
you take the difference in pressure
and multiply it by your cross-sectional area of your waist, and that's your lifting force mostly. Senator? And yeah, by the way, you get more lifting force because the seal sort of drags up on you, and there's a compliant surface around that, and half the area of that lifts, which is an important area because it's around, it's annular, out around.
Can you extend that with like a tighter, longer belt?
Oh, yeah, you could do mostly from that. The problem with that is that you end up with a wedgie,
okay.
Major wedgie.
So these are just some like little sayings
that Jim Anderson, every time I walked in the shop, he was the guy holding the foot plate, walked in the shop, and I'd say, Jim, I can't stand this project. It's been going on for a year or two, and everybody else is dropping like flies, and I'm next. And he would say, I'll just skip down. He would say things like, Mount Everest. He goes, there's Mount Everest. You're standing there in Nepal, and you're looking up at the Mount Everest, and you're going, oh my God, the mountain's too big. And he'd say, just one step at a time. Just look up there, you know where you're going, and you just take one step at a time. And I'd go back one step at a time back to my office and continue the project. And I think this is typical for anybody that's done projects. And in this class, some people have projects. Anybody here that's going to do a project in this class? Yeah. So... you'll probably find these moments where you wish you hadn't, or you'd found another project. But if you just hang in there, it'll pan out, I think.
So I think that's it there. I had a couple other. This is just a parting project. This was a fun one.
It's a windsurfing
wheelchair, which actually worked pretty well.
Low winds. You don't want too much wind.
And then this is the one that. This is the fingerspelling hand that you've... Have you already shown yesterday?
Yeah.
So that's it.
Any other questions?
I think you had mentioned earlier about the difficulty.
Yes.
Are there any consistent factors you see in terms of the difficulty? Is it just too new, too costly, too whatever?
I think that... My first guess is there's a... disconnect. I mean, you work on something, you go and present it And it's like, I didn't invent that, or it's not quite what I wanted. They weren't involved in the process. So I think Molly was talking about this when we walked in, and she's got it figured out, I think.
Holding things so close in your company, they're actually looking for things coming from the outside. But what I find is, you know, finding a company that is making something similar or has the technology to make what I'm designing, let's say, and to literally approach them specifically. And the way I'm doing it is I actually have a one sheet or a sell sheet that has the thing I've designed with some bullet points, if you will, and the moment that I hand it to the companies that I'm interested in seeing if they want to license this, I also drop my provisional patent in the mail at the same time. So I'm covered, and for a year I can play around with whoever I want to. Yeah.
Do you find then that it's the sort of not invented here syndrome somewhat?
In some companies, but not so much
not
anymore.
So much
anymore. And also, who you go to in the company makes a difference. You go to the marketing people. Don't go to the designer, because the designers are supposed to be designing, and you're coming in with something that you've designed, and it makes them look bad. So you kind of have to know who to talk to.
So maybe you're implying a little bit that it's just maybe in some ways, maybe you're too far ahead of your time. Like, in other words, if you invented the iPod, great product, just, you know, not everybody can see the applicability of
it. It could be. I don't feel that way about it. But, I mean, the hand bike was kind of fun because I think it was the first two-wheeler, but big deal. I mean, everything you do is going to have something new, I think, or you want it to be new. I think just the most important thing is establish some rapport. Start networking early and meet people at these companies that might be interested in your product. I think it's just people like anything else, more than the device, the connection you make. Okay.
You have to also demonstrate to the company that they can make money off
it. Yeah, that's right.
Okay, as you're leaving, we'll thank you for your presentation.
Thanks for your patience. Very interesting.
We can revisit this technology transfer because I have some thoughts as well. As I mentioned earlier, next Thursday is our tour of the VA spinal cord injury, and in the interest of getting people there, I have a carpool sign-up sheet. So the way this works is that it has to go around three times. The first time, people who have a car and have room in their car and are going to be at the tour will sign up. And already I'm on here and another student. So if you're a driver, you need to indicate that, how many passengers you can take, when you can meet the people, when and where you can meet fellow classmates to head off, and I'll get you the timing information next week. The second time it goes around, the passengers will sign up for a particular driver, and again include your cell phone number. And the third time around is for the drivers to know who's going to be driving, who's going to be passengering with them. So we'll start passing this around, and you can get it back to me later on. Okay, let's see. So now I'd like to bring in Owen Edwards. He's going to be talking about motion sensing devices in the assistive technology area. And Owen spoke last year as well on a little bit different topic, but he's still an engineer specializing in transferring emerging technologies in consumer and mobile electronics into projects and removing the barriers in daily living for people with disabilities. Owen has a lot of background in electronics embedded design, consumer electronics, and now he's into assistive technology. And right now he's a fellow at the Rehab Engineering Research Center at the Smith-Ketterwall Eye Research Institute in San Francisco, and he also is working here at Stanford. So without further ado, let's bring Owen. Thank you.
Thanks. Well, Dave asked me to give a little background on myself as well as some of the things that I'm working on. I have a background as an electronic engineer, as he mentioned, and I worked for 10 years in consumer electronics and telecoms products. And I ended up working on some very interesting stuff in the consumer electronics area, but felt like there was something else that I could do with this stuff. It seemed like I wasn't having as big an impact on people whose lives could be affected by technology as I wanted. And I didn't really know where to go with that. And I actually took a break. I went off, a lot of people do this before going out into your career, but I decided to go off and teach snowboarding for a little while. And fell into, really by accident, working with people with disabilities in snowboarding and in whitewater rafting. And realized that once you're an engineer, you're an engineer. I thought that I could put that behind me and go off and do something in the outdoors. And it turns out that what I wanted to do was fix problems. What I could see was that there were problems with people with disabilities snowboarding, rafting, and some of these problems are really simple problems that if you have the kind of problem-solving mind that you guys are working with, you can just say, there's a way to fix this. How do we do this? How do we make this possible? How do I use that I want to fix the problem mindset to fix problems? So after that, I came back into engineering and thought, well, there's all this great technology in the Bay Area. All this really exciting stuff being developed, but how can we use that with people with disabilities to improve their lives? So I've ended up working in research areas where some of the emerging technologies are relevant. So I'm going to talk a little bit about one particular technology that's really growing right now. I hope you guys have heard of these MEMS devices. Everybody pretty much heard of these things? They're in everything. You probably know that. And I'll talk about a couple of applications that we're using those for in a research setting and moving towards products. So, and I will skip over some of these slides kind of quickly. I've got quite a lot of slides, but they'll be available online if you want to look through it. A lot of people these days are very used to technology. People are not only used to using technology, they expect to be able to access the technology. They expect to be able to use it. People who've grown up with iPhones, video games, all these things, they expect to be able to access them. And if they acquire a disability later in life, they want to know how they can continue to use these devices. So we can leverage a lot of the technology that's developed in consumer electronics, mobile electronics, video games, to make these devices more accessible. So MEMS sensors, everybody nodded their heads. You all know what these things are. And they're a combination, a semiconductor device that's a combination of a mechanical structure and an electronic measuring circuit, something that can measure something that's going on, some kind of mechanical movement. They're typically gyroscopes, accelerometers, and magnetometers, and they're being used, as I say, in games, in consumer electronics, in portable devices. Accelerometers. This camera, you guys may have seen this camera, it's a great camera. A lot of cameras these days, including a lot of cameras that are built into phones like the iPhone, use the accelerometer to know which way up the camera is when you take the picture. It's a really simple thing, but it knows which way down is, so it knows which way you've got the camera oriented. Is it landscape or portrait? And then when you're displaying that picture later on, it knows which way up it should be. It's a very simple thing, but it works really well, and it's really changed how digital cameras work. Once these guys added an accelerometer into their camera, they realized they could use it for something else. And what they realized was that you can also tap on the body of the camera and the accelerometer will detect that. So you can use it to extend the user interface. When I was out snowboarding, I found that taking pictures was really hard because when I've got gloves on, it's really hard to use these little buttons. But this tapping on the outside of the device works really well. It doesn't work so well for taking the picture because you don't want to be tapping on the device while you're taking a picture. It kind of blurs the picture. But for most things that you want to do other than taking a picture, you can do a lot of control with accelerometers. So they're changing the way that we'll interact with devices. The gyroscopes, one place that they've gone into is in the Wii, the accessory that goes onto the Wii remote control. If you know how an accelerometer is just measuring where gravity is straight down, if I rotate that device around the gravitational vector, it doesn't know. An accelerometer can't measure that. But a gyro can. So this little device that adds onto the bottom of the Wii control allows it to know its rotation. It also allows it to know a rate of rotation this way much more accurately than the accelerometer does. Magnetometers, the latest iPhone, the 3GS, adds a magnetometer so that it can measure the orientation relative to the Earth's magnetic field. Where a gyroscope tells you something about rotation, a magnetometer tells you something about where you are relative to the Earth, the same way that the accelerometer knows where down is. So the combination of those two give you a reference frame. It gives you north, it gives you down. You know where you are oriented relative to those. So there's a number of applications where those could be interesting. Just going into a first application, where I'm working at the Smith Kettlewell Eye Research Institute. They do a lot of research on vision and on products for people with low vision. One of the issues with all these mobile devices is everything is going touchscreen these days. It's a very useful, programmable, flexible interface. But there's some issues with it. Touchscreens are really difficult for blind and low vision users. There are some real issues that a number of people are looking at. Google are doing a lot of really interesting work, and actually last year there was a presentation on Dave's course from somebody from Google talking about accessibility of touchscreens for blind and visually impaired users. Also for physically impaired users, for people who don't have the coordination to touch those buttons or can't feel the edge of a button, that can be an issue. And it's not a disability, but what about when you're driving? We all know about issues with phones and driving, but the fact is, there's all this legislation now in California, you have to wear a Bluetooth headset, but you've still got to dial the phone. And when you can feel the keypad, you don't need to look at it. With a touchscreen, you can't feel a keypad, how are you dialing? Well, maybe you can voice dial. That's one of the solutions to the problem of how do you dial. Speech recognition, or speech as an input technology, is okay, but it's not really there yet. You can't do a text message with speech. It's not flexible enough. It can't recognize enough words. And the other thing is that background noise is really tough. A lot of people don't want to be talking to their phone in certain situations, so they want another way to interface to their phone. So is there another way that we can input to our phone when it's got a touch screen? Let me give you a little background on Braille. Does anybody know much about Braille? You've seen it around, maybe know a little bit about it. Just to give you a quick background on Braille, it's a six-dot system. All the information is on the edge of the cell. That's the cunning thing about Braille. Systems that came before Braille put information in the middle of the cell, and your finger isn't sensitive enough to know that there are dots raised in the middle of the cell. That's just to give you some background on why Braille is that six-dot system. There are various different Braille alphabets, both in different countries and even in the U.S. There is standard English Braille, which has what's called a number sign that says, after this, things that previously were letters are now numbers. So actually, this representation I have up here is not that. There is something that says, everything after this is a number, and the thing that looks like an A there, that's now a 1, which is kind of confusing if you're not reading the whole thing. So they came up with a computer version of Braille. And computer Braille has basically a one-to-one mapping characters to six-dot symbols. There's obviously a limitation. Six dots only gives you 63 different characters. And there is eight-dot Braille, which is used with computers. Most people think of Braille as an output technology, though, a printing technology. And that's how it's usually used. That's how it's usually viewed. Read is as a printed technology. And there are drawbacks of it. It's not used by all of the visually impaired community. There are some limitations. But is it only an input technology? Well, obviously you've got to create Braille somehow, and to create Braille you use this big thing called a Perkins Brailler, which is like a typewriter for Braille. The thing with it that's kind of unusual compared to a regular typewriter is it has a very limited number of keys, and the six main keys, these three here, represent those dots, 1 through 6. So you press multiple keys at once, which is called cording. This isn't unique. There are other cording keyboards out there, but the Perkins Brailler is one that is a very familiar one to people who use Braille. So there's six keys for the six dots, and then a space bar in the middle, a line feed, and a backspace so that you can do corrections. There are some issues with backspace, but it's a thing that you can type Braille with on paper. The only drawback of it is, well, it's just a big, heavy device for typing Braille. But it's an existing interface paradigm. People who know Braille know how to use this. So, okay, now it's an input device. One of the researchers at Smith Kettlewell some time ago said, well, why don't we do a Braille keyboard that hooks up to a computer? Here it is, 9 keys. It's relatively small. Your fingers sit very naturally over the keyboard. It has a USB interface to a PC, and you don't need any special software. It just hooks up to a computer and you go. It looks like a keyboard. They extended the character set to do some of the things that you typically want to do on a computer keyboard. Cursor movement, selection, control, alt characters. Extended the whole character set. And this device works pretty well as an input device.
Yep. Does it input Braille characters into the computer, or does the computer translate that into actual Roman?
It comes in as Roman. It translates it.
It does. Okay.
Yeah. So it appears as a regular keyboard,
so
and it comes in
as... print that as Braille?
Well, you could. What you can do, actually, what is done on that slide is that's just a font.
Yeah.
So you can.
Okay.
You can do it as a font, but you don't have to. For people who don't necessarily want Braille on the screen.
Yeah.
And then they also may have a Braille output device. So, but it might be that they want to type in regular text and have that into a screen reader.
Or a
universal. Right. Was there another question? So this is an input device. It's actually used more as a training device for people using Braille, because they can get used to it. But some people get so used to it, well, why not use it as your input to a computer? You don't need a big keyboard anymore. So this same guy at Smith Kettlewell said to me, actually, when I first got involved with them, which is only about a year ago, he said, well, that's nice, but can we type without a keyboard? How do we type without using any keyboard, and then we can use it with a portable device? How about if we put an accelerometer on a finger and use that to detect typing on any firm surface? Is that possible? Is the accelerometer accurate enough, flexible enough? So, well, let's try it out. We tried it out, and after looking at some of the signals that we get, this is a 3D HG accelerometer, turns out you can. Turns out you can discriminate the signals that you get from the impact of a finger onto a table with just shaking it around in the air, or the movement of fingers next to that one that's hitting the table. So, okay, if you can do that, then what would you do? A little bit of detail here, how we did it. Not really important, except to say that it is possible to discriminate a finger hitting a table versus a finger next to it not hitting the table. Remember, it's a cording keyboard. By that, I mean multiple fingers are going to hit the table at once. So you've got to be able to discriminate what's going on there. And we found some various ways that we could tell them apart. Now, given that, if you've got a number of finger taps going on at once, now how do you create a chord? How do you create knowing that multiple fingers went down at once? Remember, on a regular keyboard, when you press a button, you press the button. On this keyboard, if I press 3 buttons, that's one chord, that's one cell. You need a way to connect them together. A simplification that they did with that original, with that keyboard I showed you earlier that connected to a keyboard, to a computer, was that they actually detected the key up. So if you press 3 down, they're not all going to go down at the same time, right? Ideally they are, but they're probably going to be milliseconds apart. So you've got to combine them, and you might look for when one comes back up. Well, that's okay, but it's a little weird because if you press 3 down and then you wait for a second and it hasn't typed in the character yet, that might not be how you expect it to work. Also with these accelerometers, we realized that it's actually kind of hard to detect the finger up movement. It's possible, but it's not a great way of doing it. So we said, well, how are we going to do it? How about just a time window? How about just waiting a certain length of time? Yeah, it's not particularly complicated. Turns out the kind of time that you're talking about isn't very large. 100 milliseconds is probably kind of long, 50 milliseconds, right around there. It's very easy for a piece of electronics to make that determination. And you can have a fixed one, but how about you have it so that it actually looks at how you type and says, well, what's going on here? So we're actually just working on this right now. What's a good way of dividing up multiple fingers going down? Is that one character that I'm typing, or has the typer moved on to the next character? Once you've done that, same thing. Just convert it into something that the computer understands and send it back to a computer. Little prototype, 3 fingers, worked really well. Turns out you can do this. And there's a lot of very low-cost electronics that would implement this. Now, this is only a 3-finger prototype. Obviously, I skipped ahead there. It just talks back to the computer. The same thing, it talks back to the computer via USB as a normal keyboard. That makes it really easy. You don't need any special software drivers. But the cool thing about USB is you can extend it beyond that. There are actually these things called composite devices, so you can have it appear as both a keyboard and, say, a joystick. That could be really interesting because now we've got these accelerometers mounted on your hands, now you can have some kind of gesture recognition. Now you can have a lot of things that aren't pure keyboard typing. How about this means delete? Wouldn't that be great? We thought about that, but we want to keep it pretty flexible in terms of what surfaces we're using. Are you thinking of actually listening for the sound from the fingers?
Or how do you know? I don't know. Mm-hmm. Can you tell when you've made an error?
Right. So that's actually, I'll get onto that. There are some extra things we've thought about. When we originally designed this, we said, well, it's going to be connected to something, a computer. And most visually impaired people use some kind of screen reader. So why not let the screen reader read out what they're typing? Why not let, and even maybe before that, let the computer make the click sound? Now, sure, you might want to actually integrate it into the device itself to make a click for the key going down. We thought about that. We're going to investigate that. There are a lot of options. Maybe you want to do it audibly. But you know when you're typing on your phone and the keys beep? Sometimes that's kind of annoying, isn't it? Right. A number of these touchscreen devices now, particularly the phones that have the vibration mode built in, the BlackBerry does this. It uses the vibration mode to vibrate very quickly when you touch one of the buttons. You could do the same with this. Put a little vibration device on each finger, and you'd actually feel that click. Now, then you'd have an issue of going into the accelerometer, and you might get some feedback. You'd have to deal with that. But, yeah, those are great ideas. I mean, we're trying a lot of this right now, and the user feedback is a big part of it. So obviously what I haven't talked about is the fact that you're actually looking at two hands at once, and you need to coordinate between the two hands and integrate those taps across the two hands. You can't do them independently because these two fingers going down together is a C, whereas this is an A. I need to coordinate that. What you need is a low latency link between the two. By that, I mean it needs to have a very short delay to send that information across. Otherwise, you're going to lose that timing. How are we going to do that? Well, the great thing is there's a lot of new wireless technology out there. Most people have heard of Bluetooth. You guys all know Bluetooth. You guys heard the names of some of the other ones. Have you heard of Zigbee? Zigbee is a short-range, low-cost, low-power wireless communications. It's typically used to replace a serial port. It's used in robotics. These little devices, these are about the size of a quarter. They're cheap. They use very little power. and they can be used both to send a serial signal, as I say, a serial port replacement, and to send some kind of other signals. They have what they call a digital line mirroring, so that you can send a signal onto this pin, and it appears on the same pin on the other device. So these little devices are really interesting coming out in terms of just being used in all sorts of sensing applications. They're actually looking, they're using this kind of technology for monitoring of environment. Say you put 100 sensors out in the woods and have them monitor the temperature, and they're maybe 20 feet apart, and they're monitoring the temperature throughout that area and communicating with each other. This is the kind of application that Zigbee and actually another technology called ANT, which is similar to this but is very good at talking to each other. Rather than being a one-way communication or a paired communication, what's called mesh networking. So lots of different devices talking. But Bluetooth is getting to be pretty big. People know a lot about Bluetooth now. So we said, well, if we need to talk to a mobile device, for instance, a phone, most phones support Bluetooth. Since we're going to do that anyway, and most phones don't have a USB connector, that's the only way we're going to be able to talk back to a phone or a PDA. Why not use Bluetooth to talk between the hands anyway? That's great. There are lots of ways we can do that. We can have it communicate between the hands, or we could have both hands talk back to the phone. And we can design, we're actually looking at different ways you can design the whole system architecture. So do both hands talk to the phone? Do the hands talk to each other? These are all options. One of the weird things about Bluetooth, one of the drawbacks of Bluetooth, is that within Bluetooth there are these things called profiles. I won't go into them in a lot of depth, but basically, whereas with USB you expect to be able to plug something in and it works, with Bluetooth, just because it's Bluetooth, doesn't mean that your Bluetooth keyboard works with your Bluetooth phone. It might not support that profile. Most phones support these headset profiles and hands-free profiles, but don't support some of the other profiles. So where we're at right now with the Wear a Braille project, that's the one I've been describing, is we have a two-handed prototype. As I say, it talks via Bluetooth to a host. It's actually using that Zigbee protocol with one of these little transmitter devices between the two hands. One of the issues with having it wireless is, of course, now you don't get power from anywhere, so you've got to have a battery on it. How long's the battery going to last? So part of the idea of this device was that it would be worn on, it would be designed to be built into, say, cycling gloves. The reason for that is that, well, why can't you then just wear it all the time? Just permanently wear these gloves. You're just going around, and your fingertips are free. So you can do everything you would normally do, particularly if you're used to reading Braille or handling money and feeling the size of money. Sorry, not the size, but the differences between money. They're from England. They're different sizes anyway. So it keeps your fingertips free. The idea is it keeps your hands available, but it could be built into the back of gloves and could be used all the time. So you could have a very simple way of turning it on or off that just enables it, and otherwise it's just there all the time, available to you. You mentioned a little bit about user feedback. We're looking at that. There's obviously an issue with how the gloves are made and how you mechanically interface those accelerometers to the fingers. We've looked at different mechanical interfaces, as I say, just building them into gloves, fixing them onto the fingers in different ways, and the effect that that has on the accelerometer signal and whether we can still differentiate. Then whether we can make it so that it learns a little bit about the way you type and is more adaptable rather than you having to learn it, it learns you a little bit. There's a lot of technology available to do that. So we're looking at that. We're looking at battery life and interfaces. So the good thing about this project for me was that, as I said, I had a background in engineering. I knew how to do this kind of thing, but I didn't know what the needs were. And by going to Smith Kettlewell, I found scientists who knew a lot of needs. There's a lot of needs in the rehab area that maybe the people in those areas don't know about the technology that's coming out that might help fix some of those problems. So where you as an engineer can come in is with the knowledge of, well, here are the tools. Maybe I don't know what the problem is, and maybe I don't want to be too driven by the technology. I want to be driven by a real need out there in the field. There's a lot of people out there doing research on this kind of need, and saying whether real, what would be really useful, rather than me just saying, well, this is a nice idea. So, that's one potential application.
I was going to say, because you made me think about the presenter said before you were talking about the commercialization issue.
Right.
And I think it was an earlier presentation where we were talking about needs assessment and understanding that. And
right.
Being able to proliferate technology.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems to me if you combine sort of the three, the sort of needs assessment,
mm-hmm.
which means if at that point in time you say, hey, here's my marketplace. If I extend this to make right. it more functional for a larger group,
mm-hmm.
not for a very narrow segment, I make it more commercially viable, and because I did the needs analysis.
Right, right. And that's great. I mean, actually, one thing I really got from the presentation that TV Raman did last year, he's from Google, talking about touchscreens for cell phones for people with visual impairments. As he said, it's very easy to go, well, if you can't see it, you can't use it. It turns out you can, and he came up with some great ideas for it, but he said not this applies to people, not just people who are blind, but what about when you're driving? And so it's really being able to, yeah, broaden out the scope and say this could be used. This device, I mean, we're developing it in a rehab R&D center, but we can see applications for anybody. We can see that a lot of people could use this for note-taking. The next stage is looking at things like commercialization, and that's Smith Kettlewell has some experience with that keyboard that I showed you of doing that, of transferring the technology out to another company who then commercialize it. So I'm just going to touch on one other project that I'm working on, and you will actually hear probably a little bit more about this. Jessica Rose is going to be presenting on, I think actually giving you a tour of the Gate Lab.
That's right.
When is that, a couple of weeks?
Yes.
Okay. So you'll get to understand a little bit about gait analysis. Gait analysis is typically done with this kind of setup. Actually, this is from the Gate Lab. What you have here is a lot of reflective dots on a person. And what you can see in the background here is a camera, high-speed infrared camera with infrared lights on it. And that is recording the movement of these dots. There's an array of 8 cameras on the ceiling of this lab and a computer system that's reconciling the angle from each one of these cameras to the dots, and therefore working out the position in 3D space. Based on that, clinically, they're then looking at, through a person's walking cycle, gait cycle, how does their knee flex? How does their ankle flex? How does their hip rotate? These are all things that, in a clinical setting, the surgeons are looking at to say, well, what's the limitation that this person's experiencing, or what is it that they're compensating for? The other place that this kind of motion capture is used is in entertainment. Did you say Avatar?
I didn't.
Yeah. I mean, has everybody seen Avatar? Okay. Maybe you've seen the trailers. There's a huge amount of motion capture in that movie. I've heard it referred to as like a great movie for computer graphics. It's not. It's an amazing movie for motion capture. I think I read something that they actually put some of these, these are clinical large reflective markers. I heard for Avatar they used some reflective dots inside the mouth to do motion capture. So they did a very thorough motion capture of face, then a broader motion capture of the body. So this motion capture is used a lot in movies. It's actually also used for video games to make characters move as they do based on real people. One of the things that's happening in those two industries is that they're not quite so, accuracy isn't quite so important as it is in a clinical setting. In a clinical setting, you want a very, very high level of accuracy. And this system is a very expensive system. Some of the movie companies do have very comprehensive optoelectric motion capture systems. But there's a lot of work going on with this wearable motion capture. And this is an example of the kind of suit that's that wearable motion capture. This has 17 devices mounted around the body. Each of them includes an accelerometer, a gyro, and I think with this suit they don't use a magnetometer. There are some issues with magnetometers. As I said, they are measuring the Earth's magnetic field, but magnetic field gets distorted by what? Metal things, magnets, all sorts of things. So there are all sorts of issues about using magnetometers. Some of the people who make this kind of device do use them, some don't. There's a lot of work going on about whether that's useful. But compared to an optical motion capture system, you get a much larger capture space, where normally you need all these fixed cameras, and that defines the volume that you can capture over. All of a sudden, this thing's actually wireless. This suit has a Bluetooth transmission off the back and has about 150-yard range. So suddenly you don't need to confine down that space that you're capturing the motion in. You also don't have a problem with things getting in the way, occluding your view of things. Some of the movie production companies love that because guess what? They can put a set up and the actor can act in a set and they don't have to worry about things getting in the way of their cameras. But the problem with them is that they're a little less accurate, and this thing about they're subject to drift. If you don't have the magnetometer, so you don't know where you're facing, and you're just using a gyro, long term, you lose, because you're integrating a signal with the gyroscope. Over time, any noise in that signal causes drift, and what you see with some of these suits is that over time, it can't tell if you're facing this way or this way. It loses that. It rotates people over time. And there are ways that these companies are looking to improve that. But over in the Gate Lab, we had an idea that, well, that's great. I mean, we've used this system clinically for a long time, but all this is going on, and it's less accurate, it's subject to drift, but maybe we can take some of these small devices that use an accelerometer, a gyro, a magnetometer, and we actually found a company that's been doing some work with smaller, low-cost integrated devices that are USB-connected, that run a lot of their processing on the PC that they're connected to. And Dave, you can pop up just a little video of this device. This thing's about, again, a little bit bigger than a quarter. So here it is, connected to a PC, and in real time, as you move it, something on the PC is just displaying where it is. So it knows that in real time. How cool is that? So if we go back to the slide. Thanks, Dave. Yeah, so if we connect this back to a PC, then maybe in real time, we can actually detect we can mount them in the same places that that suit had them, and in real time, we can detect what's going on with somebody's walking, with their gait. Well, why would we want to do that in real time? Well, we tried it out. We actually did some experiments with it in our motion capture lab. So here are the optical reflective markers. Here are the devices mounted, three of them, one on the foot, one on the shin or shank, and one on the thigh. And we tried them out, and we're actually just working on reconciling the data, but we already have got a pretty good measurement of knee flexion during gait. These two devices here, just giving you a relative orientation of those two segments. As you walk, let's look at the knee flexion. Don't think I have them anymore in this presentation, but doctors are looking at particularly knee flexion of people with gait abnormalities because what you see is particularly the peak knee flexion. When you hear about the gait analysis, you'll get a little more about this. But when my leg swings forward, I'm flexing my knee. Otherwise, I'm catching my toe on the ground. So I'm flexing that knee. If I'm not flexing that knee as much as is typical, there might be something going on. If I can detect that in real time, maybe I can do something about it. So we've actually done some work, as I say, in our gait lab, comparing those devices against the optical system. And what we're realizing is, one of the things with the gait lab is when people come into a gait lab, they walk a different way from how they normally walk. Yeah? It's a lab setting. How about if we could give them a system which doesn't cost, those optical systems are pretty expensive, and as I say, have a limited volume. How about we give them a system that they can go and walk around in at home or maybe just outside, away from the technicians, and then they come back in and we've recorded that data, and then we can analyze it offline. now we've taken away that the effect of them coming into a lab. More than that, how about if we can detect gait abnormalities as they happen and do something about it? Well, what could we do? Maybe we could just say, you know, you're sinking down. You're walking a little bit like this. Give them a little bit of awareness of it, kind of like a coach, right? Somebody just coaching them. Some kind of feedback, that might be useful. And actually, a specific project that we're working on right now uses this thing called functional electrical stimulation. Basically, electrically stimulating muscles to make them work. It's been done for a long time. People understand the idea that you can electrically stimulate muscles to make them work. There's a lot of research going on right now at Case Western with people with spinal cord injuries to get them walking again using electrical stimulation. And they've actually had some pretty good success at getting somebody who can't walk using a walker to electrically stimulate their legs and have them walking again.
So what that means, in essence, that a lot of the solutions we've seen that involve neurosurgery, saying, okay, somehow, or spinal surgery, somehow have to reconnect those sensors, those electricity, people can the signals get through.
Yep.
You can almost bypass that and say that, okay, I can do something external, not have to be that intrusive to get the same people.
Yeah, that's what we're looking at. We're looking to see whether that is a possibility. There are issues with electrical stimulation. It's uncomfortable. And where it's been most successful is with people with complete spinal cord injury. Because, in a sense, then you have complete control. But what about with somebody with an incomplete spinal cord injury? They've done some great research on that recently and got some success with people with incomplete spinal cord. Now you can't have the typical electrical stimulation system just triggers through a sequence in time, and it makes you walk at a certain speed, a fixed rate. Now, if you have an incomplete spinal cord injury, you might have some volitional control. The person might be setting up a certain walking speed, and they just need some assistance through that walking. There is some research that suggests that if you can do that to people, there's some sprouting going on that might actually wire past that injury. That's very optimistic research, and I'm not an expert on where that's going, but that's what people ultimately view this as, is can you get some sprouting going on to get some actual therapeutic benefit rather than just relying on this device all the time. What we're really working on is the lab that I'm working in is at the Children's Hospital, and they see a lot of children with cerebral palsy. And is there a way that you can boost some of the muscles, fire them up just a little bit more than they normally do to get the walking improved? It's optimistic research. Right. Really interesting. Actually, this lab has done a lot of work with golf swing analysis, and they've actually done some work on...
That's where the money is.
Right. That is where the money is. It's a much larger application, is golf swing analysis. They are doing some really interesting stuff on sonification of golf swing, so that you can hear the difference between a pro golfer swing and an amateur golfer. Because it turns out that's a really good feedback. If I look at a picture of me in a golf swing, I don't play golf, but if I look at a picture of me snowboarding and I'm just seeing how I'm different from somebody else, okay. But if I can hear a tone and I can hear when it goes well and I can hear when it doesn't, that gives me some great feedback. There's a lot of stuff with analysis of sports. One of the issues with all this technology is, as I say, there's a lot of really exciting technology that's coming out in non-rehab areas. Video games, movies, consumer electronics. Look at the power of the computers that we're carrying around in our pockets every day. There's so much technology there, and there's a lot of opportunity to repurpose it into assistive technology. MEMS devices are really interesting. The wireless technologies are really interesting. There's a lot of needs there, but there's problems with cost. Cost is always going to be an issue, and some of these devices are going to be really complicated and expensive. But one of the things that really plays into the cost is how big's the market, and how do you make it a bigger market? Because even even though the disabled community may be a small community, even within the disabled community, you might need to customize things for each person. So that's something to bear in mind. Is there a way you can take some technology, apply it in general to a larger part of the disabled community, and maybe spread it out beyond the disabled community? Any questions? In these ones?
Yeah.
So these, because they have an accelerometer in, so they know which way down is, and they have a magnetometer in, so they know which way north is, which way is north. So those two vectors, everything's relative to that. Yeah. And there are issues, as I say, there are issues with the magnetic field being distorted. There are, what's the other one? Just the accuracy. Some of them drift, some of them are inaccurate. And the magnetic field, the Earth's magnetic field, isn't purely north-south everywhere. So it's not a huge issue in the kind of environment we're going to move to, and we're not expecting them to travel to the North Pole, come back. But maybe they will one day. You know, you do need to be aware of some of these limitations, but that's the reference frame that it uses, is gravity and north. Any other questions?
If there's no other questions, let's thank on. So we had one round of signups for the carpool. Looks like there's four drivers, and anybody who needs a ride needs a driver. And I'll bring this again on Tuesday. I'll have a map on Tuesday so the drivers know where they're going. I'll have a location indicated on the map so we know where our destination is. I guess I'll just have it up here. Okay, thanks.